from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 4 years after the country was devastated by a U.S.-led bombing campaign, which destroyed its institutions and left dozens of warring terrorist groups from across the region free to roam its cities, Libya's civilian population continues to bear the brunt of extreme violence, with signs that the number of armed fighters may have reached 300,000 in a country of less than 5 million people. This, according to a senior UN official Wednesday. Claudio Cordone, who heads the Justice Unit of the UN Mission in Libya, or UNSMIL, said that not just one, but several wars were being fought throughout the country, adding that armed groups, quote, rule everything, closed quote. Cordone told journalists in Geneva that the UN is pursuing negotiations with the principal warring factions before condemning human rights violations on all sides. For more, we have this report from Daniel Johnson at the United Nations.
In a bleak assessment of the situation in Libya, Claudio Cordone said that there was a chance for peace, but 10 chances that things might not work. The justice chief for the UN mission in Libya said there were moderates willing to reach an agreement with negotiators. Individuals in key capitals were desperate for an end to the fighting, he said. Cordone added that the only remedy was to put pressure on regional powers with influence on the warring factions as the UN-led negotiations continue in Morocco. He cited Egypt, United Arab Emirates, Qatar and Turkey as having potentially more influence on and leverage on the warring sides. These broadly comprise Libya dawn militias in the west and a government with Western backing in the east based in the city of Baida. On the issue of human rights, the UN official said that oppression had increased in the country 4 years after the revolution that ousted dictator Muammar Gaddafi.
Libya today is reaching its most oppressive since the revolution. Both sides, both camps, and each camp is composed of a number of militias and so on, do not tolerate any dissent, any criticism in the areas they control.
Everybody is exposed and women were doubly at risk, Cordone said, citing recent murders, including that of activist Entizar Al-Hazari in Tripoli last month. Daniel Johnson, United Nations.
Massive demonstrations took place in Argentina, marking Tuesday's anniversary of the brutal U.S.-backed coup in 1976 that deposed President Isabel Perón and brought a military dictatorship to the South American nation. Press TV's Manuel Gafani was there and filed this report from Buenos Aires.
Thousands of demonstrators took to the streets in several cities across Argentina to commemorate the Day of Memory, a day which marks the start of the 1976 military coup and the most tragic and brutal dictatorship ever seen in the country. The military regime received widespread economic and political support from the U.S., and scores of violations of human rights were committed under the complicity of Washington.
My parents were jailed by the dictators, and we were eventually forced to leave the country until the dictatorship was over. Those criminals who were in power then have now been convicted and punished.
The military government who took power in Argentina back in 1976 was among many other Latin American dictatorships that were backed and even funded by the U.S. Dozens of dreadful atrocities have been reported while a neoliberal economic reform was imposed to the country. Right after the democracy was reinstated, several initiatives to bring justice to all the victims were drafted by the Congress. However, the process was crippled by the neoliberal governments who ruled the country in the 90s and were backed by the U.S.
The first democratic government revoked the amnesty laws created by the dictators themselves, but the investigations and criminal lawsuits could only be resumed 20 years later with the end of neoliberalism in the country.
For the past 9 years, the government has declared March 24th a national public holiday to honor and pay tribute to the 30,000 people who were kidnapped, tortured, and killed during the bloody U.S.-backed military dictatorship that ended in December 1983. Manuel Gifoni, Press TV, Buenos Aires.
A delegation of Iranian negotiators left Tehran Wednesday for the Swiss city of Lausanne to hold a new round of talks with the P5+1 powers on Iran's nuclear program. The delegation is led by Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The new round of talks is scheduled to kick off Thursday and is expected to run until Sunday. After the last round of negotiations ended in Lausanne last Friday, the Iranian foreign minister said, quote, good progress, closed quote, had been made, and pointed out that some work still needed to be done. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry also said that, quote, a lot of progress was made, closed quote. While the U.S. Congress has been fighting with the White House over the talks, the U.N. Security Council has also taken up the issue, with China urging the parties on Wednesday to seize the moment and reach a final deal.
The Iranian nuclear talks are presented with very precious historic opportunities. Although the negotiations are faced with many difficulties, reaching a comprehensive agreement on time is the aspiration of the international community, represents a general trend, and serves the common and long-term interests of all parties. Hence, the committee and the panel should discharge their duties in a steady, orderly way, contribute to the international efforts to negotiate a solution to this issue, and refrain from any move to disrupt the negotiation process against the spirit of the resolution.
Meanwhile, Israeli Intelligence Minister Yuval Steinitz issued a statement Wednesday calling any possible deal between Iran and the P5+1 group, quote, a bad accord, closed quote. The 14th World Social Forum opened Tuesday in Tunisia, with over 70,000 people from more than 120 countries marching to celebrate the beginning of the WSF and protesting the massacre last week in downtown Tunis. The forum will last until Saturday and is taking place at El Menar University, where more than 4,000 groups from around the world have set up seminars, workshops, and debates to discuss key issues at the local and global levels. The slogan for this year's forum is, quote, together to pursue the revolution of rights and dignity, closed quote. People's organizations from around the world are set to discuss such issues as climate justice, capitalism, racism, and feminism. The first World Social Forum was held in Brazil in 2001. It was organized as an alternative to the World Economic Forum in Davos, the yearly meeting of the global power elite. The World Social Forum describes itself as a pluralist, diversified, non-confessional, non-governmental, and non-party conference that, quote, stimulates decentralized debate, reflection, proposals building, experiences exchange, and alliances among movements and organizations engaged in concrete action towards a more democratic and fair world, a permanent space and process to build alternatives to neoliberalism, closed quote. In the run-up to last week's Israeli election, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu showed his true colors, openly declaring that he would never allow the creation of a Palestinian state and raging against the participation of what he called droves of Israeli Arabs in the election process. However, according to Black Agenda Report's Ajamu Baraka, when it comes to peace and justice for the Palestinian people, the main Israeli opposition party, which lost last week's election, is no better than Netanyahu's Likud party. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
The Zionist Union was a collection of organizations, parties, grouped around and coming out of the traditional Labor Party of Israel. And, of course, they are the Zionist Union because they are, in fact, Zionists, part of the Zionist Project, but the liberal wing, if you will. And they recognized that they had a growing problem with the continuation of Netanyahu's rule. And that is that politically it appeared to them that coming out, especially out of the last assault on Palestinians in Gaza in the summer, that Israel was facing growing political isolation, that the ability to hoodwink the international community, when we say international community, primarily the publics in the West, that somehow the Israeli project was a benevolent project, providing refuge for a persecuted people, who only wanted peace but could not achieve peace because of the resistance from these violent Palestinians who oppose this alien population coming on their land, that has been exposed for the violent, racist, colonial project that it was. So there was a shift in public opinion, and they felt that the only way they were going to be able to hold the line with public opinion in the West, ensure continued support from the U.S., was they needed a political change. They needed a Obama-ice kind of politician. And Herzog was that person, and the Zionist Union was that political formation. But in the end, they were surprised.
On the fundamental issues of Israeli policy for the last 60 years, there's basically no difference between the Zionist Union and the Likud party on the right of return, on expansion of settlements, on the basic subordination of the Palestinian population.
And that's exactly right. And that's why this is all about a public relations stance for liberal Zionists, that basically they knew that there was not going to be any significant move toward substantive progress on the ongoing conflict, if you will, in the territory. But they knew that they could package the Zionist Union in a different way, that they could force the Palestinians back to the table for some more endless so-called negotiations. The Palestinians would have the pressure coming from the international community and the U.S. to participate in that charade. And they felt that if they could do that, they could reverse some of the shifts in negative public perceptions, that they could reverse the shift in public opinion that has emerged from the last few years of the government of Benjamin Netanyahu. And this was very important because there was a growing movement in Europe toward support for a so-called two-state solution. There were cracks in public opinion, even within the U.S., and so they had a real political dilemma that they had to face, a political dilemma that was really associated to a public relations dilemma.
This is a kind of emperor wears no clothes kind of situation, where the emperor, Netanyahu, tore off his clothes voluntarily and showed himself for who he really is.
And that's what has made this a very interesting period, that with Netanyahu declaring openly now what was already clear in his policies, that there will be no viable Palestinian state, it's posed a real dilemma for the Obama administration and for U.S. policy. How do you then justify continued support for Israel? The instrument of the ongoing peace process has now been removed. So how does one then frame U.S. support for the Israeli project? So it's a very difficult situation now facing policymakers in the U.S. But there's another interesting sort of connection, too, that has to be looked at very closely in the next year or so, leading up to the elections in the U.S. And that is, with the newly established connections between the Netanyahu government and the political right in the U.S., what does that imply in terms of where Jewish public opinion and Jewish support will be politically in the U.S. in the next upcoming election, especially if the Obama administration begins to move somewhat gingerly to punish the Netanyahu government because of their positions? What might that imply for where the Jewish vote will be in 2016? Will it be in play for the first time in many years?
Yes, how do you continue the ruse when your main interlocutor no longer wants to keep continuing the ruse? This must have organizations like J Street, the liberal Zionist organization in the United States, pulling out their hair.
It must be the case. But I think that progressives have questions to deal with, too, in terms of this change. And that is, does this provide an opportunity to do two things? To really get behind in a real way the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement in the U.S. And secondly, to really get behind the notion that the two-state solution is in fact a fantasy that needs to be rejected, that if there's going to be a solution to the situation there in Palestine, it has to be one in which there is one state, one secular state that's representative of all the people in that territory. And that's something that people have to begin to take a more closer look at in terms of a viable political solution.
In the United States, the argument that Israel is the last apartheid state has been marginalized, but here we have Netanyahu sounding and looking like Bull Connor, some Jim Crow figure. This really complicates matters.
It really does, because and also affirms what many of us have argued for quite some time, that is that either there's going to be a democratic political solution to the conflict, or Israel would continue to move toward the former establishment of an apartheid state. And that exactly seems to be the course of action that the Netanyahu administration has embraced, along with a significant sector of the Israeli population. The people have to understand and recognize that there's been a profound change in the Israeli society, that there's been the same kind of rightist trajectory of politics we see in the U.S. has taken place also in Israel, but even at a more accelerated pace, so that the right-wing perspective and core value system is on full display if you just look at it, that the racist character of this colonial project and the attitudes of many Israelis are obvious to anyone who can see. And we see from the images of Israelis getting in chairs and watching the slaughter in Gaza from hillsides to the demonstrations where they are telling African asylum seekers, niggas go home, to the continued formalization of discriminatory laws directed at Israeli citizens who happen to be of Palestinian descent. It's clear that this society is moving toward a fascist configuration, and it's something that the world should be concerned about, and it's definitely something that liberal Zionists are concerned about internally, and that's why they put so much hope in the possibilities of the Zionist Union to be able to counter some of that and counter how people are seeing the trajectory of Israeli politics.
American Jews have traditionally been the second most progressive voting bloc in the United States, behind blacks and often ahead of Hispanics, except on the issue of Israel. With Netanyahu acting so blatantly racist, might even this change?
There's a possibility. And again, and I think that we're going to see how this unfolds over the next year and a half. There's a possibility that the Jewish vote can be in play, especially when we have seen that historically, for many Jews, the plight of Israel seemed to take precedence over any of their other political positions. So if Netanyahu is successful in galvanizing a sense of persecution coming from the liberal Democratic-led administration, for the first time in many years, we might find that the Jewish vote is in play. And I think that's really the main thing that might happen. I think in terms of other social issues, there will still be a continuation of the Jewish vote for, quote-unquote, progressive or liberal positions. I mean, that's really the contradiction of liberal Zionism, that there is a certain kind of progressive character to their social policies. But when it comes to Israel and the Israeli colonial project, then morality and all of that goes right out the window.
And within Palestine, Netanyahu's antics seem to have had an unprecedentedly unifying effect.
It really has. I mean, you know, there's discussion among the Palestinians, of course, the Palestinians who are living within so-called Israel proper, the 20% of the population that are Israeli citizens, around what should be the position on participating in Israeli institutions and Israeli activities like elections. Many people argue, both in Israel and in the formerly recognized occupied territories, that anything that normalizes the occupation is something that needs to be resisted. So while you have the Arab joint list coming in third in the Israeli election, a significant and very interesting occurrence, you still have significant numbers of Palestinians who are opposed to participating in the electoral process. And you have significant numbers of Palestinians outside of Israel proper who reject participation in the elections and who feel that with the re-election of Netanyahu, it helps to avoid the possibility of the Palestinian plight being camouflaged by the public relations stunts that they knew that the Zionist Union would engage in. So for them, having a clear understanding of the nature of the occupation is important. And so they are looking at the Netanyahu victory as something that is, in fact, a victory for the continuous resistance. And many of us see the victory as a victory for the growing Palestinian solidarity movement, something that would have been threatened somewhat, I think, with a victory by the Zionist Union.
And now for Palestinians, especially on the West Bank, collaboration with the Likud regime becomes more and more precarious.
Well, it's always been precarious, but it's going to be even more so But I think the real threat would have been the possibility of collaborationist activities under a Zionist union. Because of the social base of that Zionist union and the collaboration, if you will, between Jews and Palestinian Arabs who are pushing for a sort of a non-religious secular state, but under liberal terms, the possibility of them making inroads in the occupied territories had more possibilities, more danger than now with the continuation of the of Netanyahu. It's like the difference between a Bush administration and a Obama administration. You have people like Diane Nash who will refuse to march with Bush in Selma, but had no problem marching with another war criminal, Obama. So it's all at the level of perception.
President Obama came into office promising to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. He backed off of that just a little bit, but that was indicative of his willingness to go a step further with the Zionist regime, even then Republicans. What's the situation that he faces now?
Well, that's a dilemma because, you know, of course, the Zionist Union also saw Jerusalem as a unified capital of Israel. And so it poses a predicament because if there's no route toward some kind of resolution, even if that resolution was primarily mythical in terms of a two-state solution, how does U.S. policy frame itself vis-a-vis the role of Israel? And especially at this historical moment when it appears to some people within the administration, within the intelligence services, that in some ways Israel is more of a burden today than it was 20, 30 years ago. So it's going to be a very interesting period these next couple of years to see how this unfolds. I suspect that Netanyahu is going to be forced to construct this anti-terrorist argument in order to rationalize his resistance to a two-state solution. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays in the U.S. and in Western Europe. But he may be successful, and I think that the groundwork for that kind of argument was being laid back in December after the Charlie Hebdo attacks.
There are some who advocate a one-state solution, especially outside of Israel and the occupied territories, a one-state in which everyone has equal and democratic rights. How do these recent developments impact that argument, that camp?
Well, it seems to, in some ways, support that notion, especially if the Netanyahu administration has closed the door to two states, that either you have an apartheid system that U.S. policy and Western European governments are going to support, or you have to acknowledge that the only solution is one state, one democratic state with equal rights for all people. In one way, Netanyahu has sort of undermined that propaganda position that Israel had for the last 20 years with its open declaration. On the other hand, it's providing real support for those forces, both liberal and even revolutionary, who see all of Israel as occupied territory and believe that the only solution is to end the occupation and for the establishment of a state that is representative of all the people in that territory. In other words, to end the colonial project itself. That's going to require a horrific struggle because you have those elements in Israel that are not prepared to abandon their commitment to a Zionist entity.
And such a state would be about 40% Palestinian from the very beginning, and more so every year.
Exactly, and that's part of the resistance and part of the argumentation that's being used by Zionists to oppose that kind of a democratic solution, that basically the quote-unquote Jewishness of the state would be eliminated because of the demographic reality of that territory.
And how might these recent developments impact black politics vis-a-vis Israel in the United States?
Well, Netanyahu's declaration provides, I think, a political and a moral issue for members of, for example, the Congressional Black Caucus, because their support for Israel was usually dependent on a moral argument and their political position that they supported a two-state solution for Palestinians. But now with this declaration, the question becomes for them now, what will be the moral and political basis for continued support for Israel? So it's a dilemma for them now also, and something that the black people need to think about in the U.S., especially now that it's becoming clearer to black people the connection between the ongoing struggles against state violence in the U.S. and the denial of self-determination and the ongoing struggles of Palestinian people in Palestine and the political connections that have been made coming out of Ferguson and some of the other struggles we have waged in the U.S. So it has now, I think, potentially provided a real dilemma ideologically for the Congressional Black Caucus and all of the other black entities who continue to give uncritical support to Israel. Is a real dilemma now how they rationalize that support.
And of course, last summer, the Congressional Black Caucus, to a man and woman, joined in the unanimous House resolution backing Israel, even as it was inflicting a slaughter in Gaza.
Exactly. A moral position that we should always make sure that we remind people of, that basically we have for the first time that kind of unanimous support for activity that the entire world has recognized as a war crime and crimes against humanity. And we have the Congressional Black Caucus, along with its moral center, John Lewis, in full support of that brutality.
And as Glenn Ford points out in this commentary, it isn't only Israelis who have to choose between bad and worse at the polls. Israel's big brother, the U.S., has been a pioneer of the politics of the so-called lesser evil for decades, a condition which frames President Obama's recent suggestion that mandatory voting would change American politics as an absurdity.
President Obama wants you to believe that the political map of the United States would be transformed, completely changed, he says, if citizens were required by law to vote. Obama told a town hall meeting in Cleveland that mandatory voting would counteract the influence of money in the U.S. electoral process. That's a hell of a statement from the guy who wrecked the public campaign finance system by opting out of it in 2008 and outspent his Republican opponents in both of his runs for the presidency. But why does the United States have the lowest voter turnout in the industrialized world, including Russia? It's not because Americans are happier with the way they're living than the rest of the planet. And although racial exclusion in voting is very important when comparing black voter turnout with whites, white Americans also vote in numbers far below almost all of the rest of the developed world. Americans don't vote because both major political parties are answerable to the same people, the moneyed classes, the power structures that determine the issues that will be on the political agenda long before the party primaries even begin. This is called the hegemony of the bourgeoisie, the rule of the rich. The corporations and bankers choose the menu. The only option citizens have is whether to select from the prepackaged list of candidates or stay home. Almost 2 out of 3 chose not to vote in 2014. They were not behaving irrationally. Since both major parties are controlled by the rich, only the most minor tinkering with the way the country's actually run is tolerated. No matter how many people vote, very little changes, because the U.S. offers the narrowest spectrum of electoral choices in the industrial world, which is why it has the lowest voter turnout. There is much more to politics than voting. The 60s was the most productive decade in black American history, but the victories came mainly from the street. The vote can be put to good use, but not when it's cast for a Republican or a Democrat, which is why so few votes are cast on Election Day in the United States. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.